We Talk Podcast presents...
Welcome to the Stick Boy Podcast for a very fun and special episode where we talk to people in Ottawa.
Hi! Who's
been around for a couple podcasts and introducing... I think I'll leave the introduction to you, T. You'll do better than me for the new member.
Hi, I'm T. Blake. I've been on the podcast before. You may remember me from the Saint episode if you listened to that one. And a new guest.
Hello, my name is Matthew, and as mentioned, I am a junior editor working on various cooking shows.
Ooh, cooking. I'm hungry now. That's where my mind's going to go. I think we're just going to talk about TV and cameras and editing and...
And we all kind of have a very different perspective of working in the TV industry, you know, what led us to it, and even kind of our day-to-day jobs and what we do is all kind of very different. So this is going to kind of be an overview of what it's like to work in the TV industry.
Yeah, and I think we'll start with the new one. Matthew, I think we'll let you tell us a little bit of your backstory, because you've heard me and T talk before, but they haven't heard you talk, so...
Yeah, so basically my backstory is I basically just wanted to try to get into video editing and post-production in general, and I did it to try something new. So it all started with YouTube videos. It's a passion that just grew so fast, so immediately, with such a fiery drive. So I've been doing it for a total of about 8 years now, and I love it. However, my YouTube channel has not really bloomed into something big. Knowing that it's something that's very difficult and very risky to get into, I knew that I wanted to get into it professionally. So all throughout high school, I was doing videos, went into college for television broadcasting to get experience in the production side, but knowing I wanted to focus on post-production and editing. So I did work as a computer technician on the side to keep the bills paid, and it wasn't until a recent experience that led to me getting into my dream job, which is editing specifically cooking shows.
Oh, wow. Well, I'll fire a question your way. What really started, like, because you started the YouTube videos, what did you see something on YouTube that kind of led you down this path, or was it just something that's always been there since you were little?
Well, it's honestly, I always used to be so incredibly shy, camera shy, couldn't stand to see myself on camera or hear myself on microphone, but I would watch YouTube videos, a lot of YouTube videos on my spare time. And then I started to find some channels that I really grow fond of, and there was this one guy in the UK, he doesn't really do videos anymore, but he does work professionally in industry. He was doing a bunch of rant videos, actually, so I sort of thought to myself, you know what? I'm going to try this out. So I went ahead and I started making rant videos. Over time, I wanted to steer away from the rants, but this is kind of funny, but one moral that's always stuck with me is one of the music bands I like to listen to, Disturbed, you may have heard of them. They have a philosophy, which is no matter how far you get, no matter how big you become, never forget where you started. So when it comes to YouTube videos, the popularity hasn't gotten too big, but the time, the duration I've been doing it has been so long. So I try to follow that moral of not forgetting where I started, which is the rants. So even though I branch off and do a bunch of different things, I still now and again turn back to my original growth, which was the rants. What? So that's how the YouTube itself all started.
Well, what would you rant about?
Oh, frig, I'd rant about everything and anything, any little thing, any big thing that would frustrate me, from anything political related to anything technological related.
One of his videos with the highest number of views is a rant about UPS, wasn't it?
Yes, UPS. So anything that would come to mind that would piss me off, I would do rants about. And then I started being like, you know, like people would be like, oh my god, like you're seriously ranting about, I don't know, people who chew their nails, or like small things like that. So I sort of divide it into like, okay, these are the serious rants, these are the non-serious rants. But of course, nobody really paid attention to that. So it just kind of came down to steering away from the rants for the most part, because what was a turning point for me was the fact that it took a lot of time and a lot of energy to make videos. And I wasn't satisfied making something that in the end would frustrate people and get angry over watching them. It didn't feel good. So I wanted to start doing videos that were much more on the entertainment side, so that people could get a more enjoyable experience watching the videos.
Oh. I definitely think, T, we could have a rant off between Matthew and Jesse.
Oh my god. That would... That'll be another special episode of the Stick Boy podcast.
Oh, I'm down for that.
Just two guys ranting for an hour. That'll be a super long episode.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we'll just sit off in the corner and just kind of be...
We'll be the moderators, each holding our side back.
Jesse would find some common ground, but so that's really neat. So then once you finished high school, did you take any courses? Like, did you go to a specific school where you lived? Like, what was your next step after the YouTube videos in high school? What was that next logical step to get you to the point that you are today?
Well, it actually did also start in high school. While we were in high school, there were some career samplers that were offered where they let specific handpicked students go to the college and test out certain programs. So at the time, I wanted to get into police foundations. So I actually took a career sampler that was a week long for police foundations, and I had a hell of a fun time doing it. But what really made me say to myself, this is not for me, was one of the police officers said that being an officer isn't just a job or career, but it's a lifestyle. And that's where I just thought to myself, you know what, I just don't feel that's the lifestyle for me. So later down the road, when I was heavy into the video making and I knew that television broadcasting was one of the programs, they offered me to take a career sampler for it. Now, that career sampler was not a week-long program. It was actually just, I think it was either 1 day or 2 days. And that 1 or 2 days... we did a little bit of studio experience, and that is where it just felt so right. So right from that point, while in high school, I was in that situation of, I know what I want to do as soon as I'm done high school. The problem for me was the financials. So when all the other students and my friends were immediately going off to college next September, I was in a financial position where I couldn't do that, where I wanted to work a little bit and save up some money first. So that's exactly what I did. We moved we moved within the city to be close to the college so I could just, you know, walk or bike to the college instead. So that's where I went into the program, and 2 years later, the rest is history.
Yeah, you got to say the name of the college. Not all the listeners are from Ottawa.
That's right. I went to Algonquin College, which is a very, very popular college within the area. People who are from different cities know about Algonquin. And I'm not sure. I think it might be every single college that brags about it. But from what I heard, I think they said Algonquin was voted either number one or number two for the best television program offered in, I think, all of Canada.
Oh, that's impossible. Saint has the best program in all of Canada, doesn't it, Joel?
Some days it did, some days maybe.
We honestly had some downfalls there. As many good things as I could say about the program, there are also a couple not so good things I could say.
Oh yeah, I think with any program at any school, there's going to be positives and negatives. Like, I know here in Calgary, we have Mount Royal University has a broadcast program, and SAIT has their own television production broadcast program, and they're very different. But at the end of the day, you see people out in the TV industry or out doing whatever, and it's both of them doing their thing, and it's kind of like, and both kind of compare their schools and kind of go, well, this is better for this, but, well, this is better for this. And at the end of the day, it's just kind of, you've learned something. It's really taking that knowledge and moving forward. What were those 2 years like? Because I know what my 2 years at SAIT were like. What was it like for you in this school? What was the environment like?
So the environment was very much, I was never one for the party frat boy kind of scene. And when I went into college, that's exactly what was in college, was the whole party hooligan kind of thing. So I had to get used to that in a social sense. And in a professional sense, I, of course, had to get used to the much more, well, I always had the hands-on experience, but it was more the workload that I had to get used to more. But what was, for the most part, within my program was the whole division of getting the experience as a whole. Now, when you want to get into broadcasting, it's a huge field in terms of all the work that's to be done. So it was the kind of program where you had to do everything from pre-production, from production to post-production. And regardless of how quickly you learned what you loved and what you didn't love, there wasn't as much. There was still some opportunity, but not as much opportunity to really branch out into the division you want to get into. Whereas in the second year, that's where you were able to focus on what you really wanted to do and focus less on what you didn't want to do. So it was a mix of trying to balance that professionalism in the program versus the whole scene of the kind of students that were around.
I think I don't know about UT, but I think there's definitely almost a similar vibe to SAIT. I think any college or university is going to have that, where you've got a mishmash of people from different stages in their lives that are going to be like, well, I'm here to get drunk and do this, and there are some people like, I'm just here to learn and get out. I think the vibe that SAIT had, I think we had a lot of fun. I think there was a little bit of partying, and there was a little bit of hanging out and going out for drinks or going off and watching.
Well, yeah, listeners to the SAIT episode know about some of the shenanigans that went on, but...
there were several shenanigans. Some will never, ever be admitted on air.
Oh, of course not. But I think it's almost good, the college experience versus the university experience, of that having people in different stages of their lives. It's not, in university you have people that are kind of all the same age, all the same maturity level, a lot of them away from home for the first time. So from the stories I've heard of university, almost all my friends went to universities. It's a vastly different experience than going to a college or a technical college or the programs like they were offering at SAIT and Algonquin, where you get people in the more advanced stages of their lives. You know, you get people in their late 20s, early 30s, and there was a lady in first year, when we were in second year, she was in her 50s, wasn't she?
Yeah. So now, you spoke about kind of what the first year and second year was for you, or how they had it structured. Which year did you prefer? Which year really, really set, where you enjoyed? Because I remember for SAIT, my second year, having a camera in my hand and just going and working 11-hour days, or going off and having a shoot in the morning and then shoot in the evening, or just going off and setting up for a time-lapse with Jesse or anyone else from that program, and just kind of going and doing stuff was probably my most fun. What year produced the most fun for you?
The year that produced the most fun for me was definitely the second year, for many reasons. In some reasons it was a worse year, in some years it was better. The first thing is we pretty much stayed in the same group. So the second year rolled around, it wasn't so much as, oh, who are you? Let's get to know each other. It's, oh my gosh, it's been 4 months over the summer. How you been? All that. So you felt like you had a better connection with both the profs as well as the students. I loved the fact that the stuff that we really didn't want to do, like in studio in first year, we had to do rotations, meaning in a studio setting, we had to do every single position throughout the whole semesters, whereas in second year, we didn't. If we loved audio, we could stick to audio. If we loved camera, we could stick to camera. But more importantly, for someone like me who wanted to get into post-production, we had the opportunity to take the advanced editing class, but as mentioned, it wasn't always the best situation, because the thing is, every prof was clamping down on the whole seriousness of everything, so even those classes that you were not so much interested in, such as EFP, where you go out and shoot actual videos and that, if there was a program that was not of interest to you, and it had immediately pending projects that were big, you didn't want to focus on that. I don't care about this scene-paving EFP project. I care about the advanced editing. There's all these tutorials on Lynda that I can learn and do more in, but I can't do it right now because I have to focus on this other one. So that was a bit of a hindrance in a way, in the second year particularly. We did have that excitement of our internships, which is where we actually go out in the work field. So we got to talk with our prof, which is, if we wanted, in my case, wanted to get into post-production, then we looked at the post-production internships that were available to us. So we had that excitement of, I'm about to go in my field. So you could go to bed at night knowing that something is actually going to come of it.
Now, you kind of spoke about like a hindrance. Did you feel at any point like some of these classes that you had a little bit of interest, offered you a little bit of little nugget of something that you could use in the classes that you were interested in, like a little skill or something that you could be like, hey, if I take this, I can apply this to here, and these are the possibilities that I could have?
Yes, absolutely. The thing about broadcasting as a whole is you can't focus on one thing and one thing only. It takes a good editor to know good camera techniques. Especially if you're going to be in a leadership position such as a director or producer, you can't understand everybody's roles unless you've done it all. So good editors shoot well and good shooters edit well. So you have to know what to look for and all that. So you know what's wrong with specific shots or certain techniques or everything. So you have to get that experience. And I mean, yes, when I do my own YouTube videos, I do get both the production and post-production experience as a whole, but not everybody has that self-discipline, and they have to have it forced down their gullet in a college situation where marks and graduation is of essence in order to do it. So absolutely, it's important to get a taste of every single position.
Yeah, like I think the one thing, and I'll let you speak on this first, D, but I think one of the biggest things was at SAIT was we were kind of divvied off to shooter, editor, producer, and at times I think there were certain spots that kind of got left in the dark a little bit, and were left not able to touch a camera or not able to edit.
I definitely agree. I mean, because I was divvied off into that editor position, I was always editing. I kind of realized recently, I mean, I have a DSLR and I, you know, go shoot things for fun, but I haven't touched a professional camera and done any professional camera work in about three, almost 4 years now, because from second year on, I was an editor and that's what I was. I had no more camera experience. I mean, I could, you know, it could probably come back to me with practice, but if someone, you know, put a PMW EX1R in my hands, I would be like, I don't remember how to do any of this because I haven't touched it in 3 years.
I'm shocked you still remember the camera name.
Oh, Shane would just skin me if I didn't. You know, Sony PMW EX1R, that was on our camera test. You had to know the name of the camera.
I'm impressed. But I definitely agree. I think that, like, for me, it was for the shooter component, for say, it was a little bit easier to kind of do a little bit of producing, have to make phone calls and book certain things to do certain things, and also have to edit my own stuff and kind of cut my own stuff. And I also did some of my own little things onto the side. And it really just came from that, I need to do this because this will make me better. And it has paid off in the industry, being able to wear all three hats. But I've had conversations with several people in the industry, and someone had brought up a point about you don't want to wear all three hats. You want to wear two hats. You don't want to wear all three, because then you're not focusing on two skills. You're trying to focus on three, and trying to develop three skills at once can be a lot more tricky and a lot more challenging than focusing on two skills and growing those. So what do you guys think of that? Because there's really three hats for this production, which is producer, shooter, editor. How do you feel? Should people be focused on one skill, two skills, three skills? Where do you stand with that?
I think it's kind of, you should grow all three skills, but you shouldn't have to use all three skills at once, if that makes sense. If you're working on a documentary or a project or something, you don't want to be producer, shooter, editor, because one, you're going to burn out. You are. Two, you have no outside perspective, because what you think looks good may not actually look good, or you may not be fully getting the message across because it may make sense to you, but it doesn't make sense to your audience or whatever. So I don't think there's anything wrong with growing all three skills, but yeah, you are right about the focusing on, you know, one or two at a time. Like, I'll be the first to admit I don't have the greatest people skills, so I definitely need to work on that as well as my editing. But yeah, I'm not going to do all three at once. I'm going to take my turn developing each one.
Yeah. Matthew?
I have to say it's definitely important to know all of the elements. Basically, the way I see it is, can you do an entire production on your own? And if the answer is no, ask yourself, what don't I know? Now, I'm not saying you need to go and shoot a friggin' Steven Spielberg-quality movie on your own, because we all know that's impossible to do. But with the way YouTube is, you can create absolutely anything. So when I make my own YouTube videos, I know how to make the script, I know how to make the pre-production happen in terms of the script writing, I know how to make, in terms of an actual production, how the camera shots are supposed to work, how the audio should be, and how to edit it. So by the end of the day, can I make my own production happen from beginning to end? Yes. And if somebody else were to answer no to that, then ask, what don't I know? And if there is that one thing that you don't know, learn it and do it so that you can at least do it adequately. Because especially, like, yes, you want to focus and spend lots of time and energy doing that one or two things that you really love. But what also makes a huge difference in the industry is your willingness to branch out into where you're not as comfortable. Because things change all the time. And even in a post-production environment, you're working with production people. So when someone's running around with their, it's like their head is falling off, they're running around like crazy, and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do about this. If you just pipe in and say, I can help by doing this, I might not be the best audio person, but if I can at least offer an audio service to fill that hole, people are going to go to you because you're willing to do more than what you're assigned to do, and people recognize that and notice it.
Especially in today's world, and you see it more in kind of news production than at production houses and in TV production, but the more you can do, the more valuable you are. Most reporters these days are reporters, shooters, editors, you know, especially for small networks. If you're in some small town somewhere, you have to be able to do everything. And if you have all those skills, you're more likely to be hired, even if you don't necessarily need to do that. Like the reporters at, let's say, Global or whatever, usually have a shooter that shoots and an editor that edits. But if they know how to do those skills, they're more likely to get that job in the first place, because then they can fill any one of those three roles.
Yeah, I definitely think, like, for me, I've been kind of going off and I've been picking up little things here and there that I know might not be my strong suit, but I can take these little skills and I can pocket them and I can use them. And it's afforded me more opportunities and more chances. Like, there's certain things that, like, branching off into areas that my comfort level's not at the highest. I'm like, oh, I can do this, no problem. But at the same time, learning those skills and slowly being comfortable with that and being able to go, okay, I can do this. What's next? What's the next thing? I don't think, for me, the hunger for knowledge will never fully be like, okay, yeah, I know what I need to know. It's always going to be like, well, what can I do to continue to further myself? And especially in a industry and a landscape that's always changing and evolving to more of a digital platform where you have to be more adaptable. You have to understand social media. You have to understand how to shoot on your phone at points, because there's ENG stories that are shot on cell phones now, cut and edited and thrown on air, and it's shot on a cell phone, and it's just the way things have gone now, and it's trying to almost predict where things are headed and going. And just trying to make sure you're keeping up with stuff. Because if you stay just as a shooter, just as an editor, you're going to get lost in the dust in the ever-growing industry.
Mm, for sure.
So once you finished, where'd you do your internship, Matthew?
When I had my internship, mine was actually in Toronto. There was a distillery district, which is a very old building area within Toronto, right in the heart of downtown. So I had my internship for a company that focused on creating infomercials. So that was my internship. And I had the great opportunity of working with someone who was in the Toronto area was apparently a high name in the industry. So that was a really good opportunity for me to get to know and network So being there, I helped the company move from one location in the district to another. I did lots and lots, and I mean lots, of converting tapes to hard drive. But I also had the opportunity to do graphics and cutdowns of various infomercials, which was a great way of executing extreme cutdowns while maintaining story. So that was a internship that I had that did turn into a contract work, which was great. But then after I moved into Ottawa, that's where I know that I wanted to stay due to family. Despite loving the work that I do, I'm very much a family man and would like to do everything I can to maintain that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This industry can definitely play a – it can definitely be a grind on that, having that balance. But so once you finish your internship, was it job right out of your second year? Was it finding that right away and everything kind of lined up? Or was there a little bit of a lull where you're kind of looking around and hoping to find something? Because at least here in Alberta, when myself and T had graduated, the economy wasn't that great. So was it a similar situation for you out in Ottawa, or was it very easy for you to find the next step?
To be honest, it was, because yes, I did have a short-term contract with the company, but when that expired, I did not have any more work. So I had to go back to the old retail job that I had, and then when I moved back to Ottawa, I was still maintaining the same retail job because I moved from one location to another. So I did have trouble trying to find work. Especially one thing that people told me is, oh, wow, you moved from Toronto to Ottawa to get work, because the industry is a lot bigger in Toronto. There's a lot more post-production houses. However, one thing that I knew in the back of my head is, even if I could get work faster in Toronto, even if it took longer in Ottawa, I knew that I wanted to stay in Ottawa. So yeah, there was quite a bit of time that went by. I did get a little bit of trying to get some guidance of where to go. And it's funny, because it seems like in this industry, yes, it helps more about who you know. And experience is one of the biggest saves, because so much internal hiring is done as opposed to external hiring. So getting your initial foot in the door is the hardest friggin' part about it. Sorry, I just lost my train. I thought I was going with that. I knew I was going somewhere. Okay, yes, but to get that first foot in the door, it was very much a whole situation of the cards just kind of lined up. It almost felt like it was, I hate to say luck, because I knew it did come from my own hard work that paid it off, but I think for most people, to get that gear rolling is all about being ready and always be ready, because that opportunity will happen, but it's just the way the cards line up.
Yeah, I know for me, it was definitely very much like right place, right time. Yeah, to get your foot in that door is either, you know, you better impress the pants off whoever, you know, you do your internship with, or you be at the right place at the right time. Yeah. But once you get in, stay in, keep those networking contacts, because it's all about who you know once you're in.
Yeah. Oh yeah, once, like, I think similar situation for me. I kind of, right place, right time, just things kind of aligned. It took a little bit longer, but things did line up for me. But it was that just going out and going, okay, I can do this. I know what I've done. I know what I've accomplished so far, and this will help carry me. And just being able to talk to the right people and have the right people back you. Because a lot of times, all you need is the right person to back you, and then that can propel you forward and push you to the next step, and then to the next step. And that's a big thing, because once you've got in good with a few people, and like you've said, a lot of companies promote from within, so once you have that foot in the door, then you just gotta ride it out to either this is not the career for you, or this is the way I want to go. So now that now we kind of know your backstory, what I'd asked T this on the previous podcast, what advice do you have for someone that's sitting in high school right now and thinking about TV or thinking about film or anything along those lines, because they run very parallel? What advice would you give them to get them going or to that next step or get to a SAIT or any other school within Canada, North America.
So my biggest piece of advice to anybody who's in high school and is considering getting into this kind of field is make it your hobby. When you have a hobby, absolutely nothing holds you back but yourself. So take the time to have fun with it. Go onto YouTube. You can post within limits whatever you want. And you're going to gain so much experience in terms of both production and post-production. And it doesn't cost you anything. Sure, if you want to get specific equipment, that could cost you money. But hey, you're still in high school. Santa still brings you stuff, right? So just ask for the right thing. Again, once you make that your hobby, you'll know what you want to get into. You'll know if it's for you or if it's not for you. Because so many people who don't have hobbies, who don't explore those kinds of things, they're the ones who go to college and they realize this isn't for me, and they might drop out, and the debt piles up and piles up. When you're looking at doing new hobbies, whether it be not just in television broadcasting, but in any kind of field or little hobby you want to get into, if you want to get out of that hobby, it doesn't interest you, you have nothing to lose. So absolutely, as is, just get out there, do everything you can. And it also helps toughen you up a little bit, because, yeah, the internet can be a really tough place in terms of when people comment, but it develops an emotional callus on you, and that you can get advice from the most important, well, one of the most important people, which is the viewers, about what they want to see. It helps build your character so that by the time you get to big producers and people who are in companies, you have that sense of like, you know what you're doing, and that's something that they really value to see. If you could go in there and already have a bunch of personal experience, because there's a lot of people who are in the industry who have not sought post-secondary education and still get in. I don't recommend going that route, but it's because they have that experience and pride in the industry due to experience.
Yeah, it's all sound advice. Like, it's definitely, like, this industry, it's a lot of just going out and doing and trying. Or, like, with anything, like, I don't recommend if you want to be a surgeon to go and try being a surgeon. That probably doesn't work out. But for something like this that has some creativity, anything with real, that creativity is at its heart, it never hurts to try. Like, at the end of the day, if you're making something you feel very passionate about, go do it. There's no reason to just sit there and be like, oh, well, I can't do it. There are far less talented people out there doing it, and if you've got a story or you've got something within yourself that you want to tell, do it. What's the worst that could happen, really?
Yeah, we're very fortunate to live in a time where cameras and microphones and everything are becoming cheaper, are becoming easier. It's the age of YouTube and social media. It's easier to get yourself out there. And yeah, there are some people that started from nothing, that started from, you know, shooting little YouTube videos with their iPhone in their backyard. Now, like Matthew said, you know, if you want to be a professional, having a college degree really is a big asset, but, you know, we're fortunate enough to live in an age where that can be your start. It's easy for you to explore that as a hobby and maybe make a career out of it.
Yeah.
That's a good piece of advice. I've had a couple people come up to me who want to get into making YouTube videos, and they say, they ask me, like, you know, I want to start. Where do I go? And one thing that I've always told people is, don't go out and spend thousands of dollars on a camera, hundreds of dollars on audio equipment, because you don't need that. My philosophy is, work with what you got and only upgrade your tools if they are holding you back. Because to be honest, I've gone to garage sales and gotten friggin' touch lamps or desk lamps for 50 cents to $5, and I've used those as lighting. And as long as you know your placement, you have some basic lighting skills and can make some little cutouts I've done cookie cutters for lights out of friggin' paper and cardboard. Mm-hmm. And people have made great microphone setups with cheap microphones and just using friggin' broom poles as the audio poles. So if you are thinking about getting into it, then my advice is don't initially fork out a bunch of money. Start with some simple, cheap things, and then once those tools hold you back, then upgrade so you don't waste a bunch of money and find out that you're going to post up an ad for it and hope to only get maximum half the money back.
Yeah, and it's definitely one of the things is the gear, you make the gear work for you. The gear won't do it for you. The gear's not just going to magically show up and shoot this stuff. It's up to you to make it happen. So I definitely agree. Like, and I think we saw it at SATE where people got creative, and I still see in the industry where you dummy things together and you just kind of connect A and B and go, okay, let's hope this works, and just...
Oh my god, yeah, our dolly was like a wheelchair stolen from the men wing years ago. Like, yeah.
And that's the thing, and it works, and it gets what you need, and knowing what it's good for and what it's not, knowing that, okay, well, I shouldn't take this here, but I can use this here. And being very smart with the gear. So you did your internship. You found that job. So what do you exactly do at your job? What's a typical day for you?
So a typical day for me is a junior editing position. So what my purpose is to get everything prepped and ready to go for the senior editors. I got to be honest, it's a position that I truly love and have had a blast doing, because the reality is when you go on an 8-hour shoot, you have 8 hours of footage. Not just one camera, but multiple cameras. So there is so much filler and so much garbage that will take up so much time to go through. So what I do is I take the hard drives that have the camera dumps on them. I ingest them into the video editor, which in this case is Avid Media Composer, and I sync multi-camera setups together. Make sure they're all properly synced up, and I cut out all the bad takes, all the dead air. I build the initial projects so that everything is organized so that they can literally just dive in and do what they need to do. I, of course, have done other things too. I've created webisodes, which once episodes are finished, then I take these recipes and I cut them down into about 2-minute short segments for people to watch, which, again, plays into the whole multi-platform, strong online delivery of content to viewers. I've done some other things too. I've cut down auditions, which is something that it's honestly a huge part in the whole process, because you have people going across the country having these auditions, and they're long. They're like 30 minutes, and the producers don't want to sit there for 30 minutes per person and watch through all that. So I actually cut. It's up to me to decide what the producer, or in some cases, the CEO of the company sees and doesn't see. So I'm sort of building a visual resume for other people. It's important stuff here. Some of the things I've done, let's see what else I've done. Serve coffee. Not actually serve coffee, but a coffee maker, but I sometimes clean the thing out. I've done, again, if this plays into being ready and being willing to do other stuff, is I've just literally driven across the city to pick up hard drives from set and bring them to the place or the storage facility, because it's usually people on the production side that do that, and they're always busy. So I've helped out on that side, just so that people from the production side and higher up in the company say, hey, this guy cares.
You built a couple editing systems and set them up,
right.
Actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done that both in my internship and at my actual position here. It plays being a computer technician, is I've built editing setups. That's been fun. I mean, it sounds complicated, but it's simple stuff, but they appreciate that kind of thing. Because some editors, I can't believe this, there are some editors that don't know how to do basic computer troubleshooting or even setups. And if one thing goes wrong, we have an editor that is in a different city and they can't do certain things. So we have some hoops to go through to try to make that kind of thing happen.
Yeah.
So there you go, tips for anyone who wants to be an editor or work in the industry. Know how to work with computers. You don't need to be able to build one from scratch, but basic troubleshooting of the editing programs and of your computer itself is a huge asset.
Oh, yeah. And being able to swear at it, too, right, T?
Oh, yes. If you work in the industry, you'll hear a lot of swearing. It's not for those with, you know, who are offended by swearing or sensitive or anything. It's... Yeah, we swear a lot.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Like, today, like... What I was working on today, there was lots of swearing.
I may have become known in college for the most creative swears when the computer crashed.
Oh, yeah. Like, I remember Edit Suite, you could hear you. The door would be closed, and we would hear you swear and be like, well, Avid's down again.
Yep.
And just kind of walk away for a few minutes. We'll come back in a few minutes, Jesse. Don't.
Yeah, well, that ties into the knowing your computer as well, because... programs are going to crash. You know, maybe your computer's hardware and software mess up. Maybe Adobe released an update that your computer doesn't like. Maybe Avid is just being Avid again. Avid is known in the industry for being kind of difficult to work with. But it's a wonderful program, but it's just kind of difficult to work with. So yeah, that ties into the knowing your computer and knowing troubleshooting. Yeah.
I think we've all met those people who grab a thumb drive or email themselves the Adobe Premiere project save file and think it's going to work. They think that's their entire project. Little do they know when they go and fire up another machine, why is everything offline? I have my project right here. Well, your 1 hour video is 20 megabytes. That doesn't seem right, does it?
I've definitely noticed that they're just seeing people like, oh, this is really easy, and it's really, really not. There's a lot of things, especially for the editing side, you have to be very careful making sure everything stays connected, because then if you lose one little thing, then you're left kind of running around trying to go, okay, how do I link everything back? What do I need to bring into here to make sure this works? And it's just a whole rigmarole of not fun. So it's definitely valuable to know what you're doing, at least on a basic level, being like, okay, everything's here, I'm good.
Very much so, yeah.
It's definitely a fun industry. Like there's some days where there's crying, and there's some days where it's like, this is awesome, let's do this again. Like I was out shooting a sunrise, and
nice.
T knows, I'm not a morning person.
Oh, no, you're not.
I don't like mornings. I will sleep in, but just being out in a specific spot in Calgary and seeing the sunrise, being out with a camera, it's just like, oh, yeah, this is why I do stuff like this. Okay, yeah, I remember now. And it's just a really cool little experience that is like, I'm at a nice little spot, I'm by myself, and I see this, not by myself, I have another camera with me, but being out there and just seeing it, it's like, yeah, this is really cool.
Yeah, but then when it's minus 20 outside and you go off to shoot some snowboarders or something, I'll be laughing at you for my heated editing suite.
Yeah.
What gives me that feeling the most is in terms of when I create my own content through YouTube, is when I had that first idea of that video in my head, be it big or small, and then I go through the work of shooting it, recording it, blah, 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 when I get to the very end of it, and then I render it out, I make it viewable to the public, and I watch it over, and I just have that comparison of how it went from my head onto that computer screen, and sometimes it comes out exactly as I thought, and other times it turns out completely different, usually in still a good way. And also, being in the industry where everything is team-oriented, I have so many moments where I sit and then I watch what's become of all that work, and I can say, wow, I am so proud to at least be a part of this.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. There's definitely, you sit there and you see stuff and you're like, you see your own idea come to fruition, and I'm like, This is really cool. Like, I remember working on videos, like little silly videos that we would do in Sate, and just seeing it all click and going, holy crap, we made this. This is awesome, and especially when you're making it with friends. It's like, this was really cool.
Very much, yeah.
This industry, it's not for everyone. It can definitely suck you in and spit you out. But when you find what you really love to do, then it's really, really worth it at the end of the day. Yeah.
I always tell people it's the balance. This is the kind of industry where it's a balance of technical and creative. And that's what keeps me going, is having that balance of the both of them. And I've been told from my parents that I'm creative, but I can't draw. I can't paint. I never really thought myself as a creative person, but it's how can my creativity be delivered? And videos is totally the way that that happens, because of what comes into my head and it comes to reality on that screen.
Yeah, I can't say it any better. Like, there's just something about the creative side that, like, and you're absolutely right. It is that. It is the marriage of creative and the technical side coming together, and you're like, holy crap, this happened. This worked. What projects have you worked on that you've been very proud of, that you can be like, I did that? Like, not on a personal level, but professionally.
On a professional level, definitely. It would be the two projects that I've been working on during production. Like, okay, every single production has problems. Every single production has nightmares. So I would speak to one person and like, oh my God, like, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is terrible, this is awful, this is horrible. But yes, there are those bad things, but like, when I look at the end result, I think, holy fucking, well, can I swear?
Oh, yes, yes,
oh,
yes.
Okay, I can swear.
She got to say whatever she wanted.
Yeah,
so.
I think, holy fucking shit, this looks absolutely amazing. And to anyone else who watches it, they would not know about all those problems that happen. When those problems happen, we stomp on them. We you know, the term curb stomp them. We get rid of them and we make it happen. So it's funny, because cooking is one of my extreme hobbies. Ever since I was young, I loved to cook, and I gotta be honest, I've had little fantasies, little dreams of being able to work on cooking shows, like in both the production and post-production. But I always thought it, I don't know if I'm being too hard on myself, I always thought it would be too far-fetched for me to achieve, and for me to just stop and think, wow, I am doing exactly that. So it doesn't really matter what show it is, whether it be this TV show or that TV show. Just the fact that I've contributed to it is something that is most proud to me. So every show has its specific moments of why it's my most proud. So just the fact that it's a cooking show in general makes it my most favorite professional project.
That's awesome. Any projects that you've worked on lately that have been, because I know you've worked on some interesting shows here and there. Is there anything that particularly stands out for you that you're able to talk about?
Well, my perspective is a lot different. I work on a lot of government videos, so a lot of my videos are never really released to the public. They're only released within government agencies. So, you know, the public doesn't really get to see them. I have worked on a couple TV shows, but, you know, I didn't contribute as much, so, oh, God. Probably, I did do one video, I've done a couple videos, that are either currently or will soon be playing in national parks in Canada. I don't know if I can name them, I'm not sure if I can, but I've worked on a couple that will actually be shown to the public in several national parks about animals. And that's really, really cool, that to think that maybe some visitor, you know, is from China or Australia, or because I've been to some of these national parks and seeing the amount of visitors that go there, and maybe my name isn't on it the way, you know, Matthew's name might be in the credits of something, you know, maybe my name isn't on it, but I made that, and people from around the world are going to see it, and that just blows my mind that me sitting there in my little editing suite, I'm going to make something that, you know, someone from thousands of kilometers away is going to see. So, yeah, that's probably my most proud one.
Both are really cool. I think, like, for me, the proudest, like, my proudest stuff has always been kind of, like, with the Stick Boy production side. And anytime I've been able to complete a wedding, because they are stressful. They will take years off your life. They will burn you out. You have to deal with a bride and a groom, and you have to make sure you're in the right spot and that your second camera is good and making sure you're getting all the footage and nothing's getting corrupt and you're not missing this one little joke from an uncle that they desperately need to have in the video and making sure they see the video and they're happy. And just seeing the bride's face when they can relive that day again and knowing that you were able to contribute positively to them and that they can sit there and watch that video over and over again and know that you helped bring something positive for them and bring a little bit of happiness. So I think that's my proudest. And any podcast that features you, T, is right.
Oh,
up there.
Of course, I'm just a national treasure.
We won't go that far. There's so many different avenues with this industry that the possibilities are endless. Like, I mean, Matthew, did you have like a broadcast radio component for your TV? Did you have a radio and broadcast component for your school, or was it just straight TV production?
So in our college, Algonquin, there's buildings that are divided up into separate programs. And of course, Algonquin covers such a huge spectrum of different industries. So the building that I spent most of my days and long editing nights in would be the N building. And that N building was shared with... on the main floor, we had the TV production, and we also had the radio broadcasting. So radio was a separate program, but on that main floor, we also had the theater students. And then on the top level, where we never really went, we actually had the artistic, I forget what program it was in, but they actually do drawing. It's like graphic design, I think that was one of the programs. So it's a lot more of the typical drawing kind of stuff. So yeah, the radio was a separate program. We did not cover any radio-related stuff in our program at all.
Okay. Well, that must have been very interesting, because we had like nurses, doctors, paramedics around us, and you guys had theater kids. You must have had quite the interesting plethora group of personalities running around.
We didn't have a theater program at SAIT, so...
Yeah, we never really interacted much with them unless we were in the hallways. Most of the mixing came with other buildings. The P building is an entirely dedicated police, ambulance, firefighter group, and then there's an entire building dedicated to the business, which the business program is pretty well just computers and people in business suits and business attire. So the good thing about that was we had so many EFP productions where we had to showcase different industries as a whole, and we could do it just by a 5-minute walk to somewhere else. There's even automotive mechanics programs and everything. And we also had all the sports teams. So whenever we had our remote broadcasts that we did, as much as I really disliked the content of covering sports, I do have to give it credit at the fact that being able to set up a radio broadcast at the college and not have to go to location was incredibly convenient.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's what I really liked, actually, about our documentary we did in the second year, Rising to the Challenge, because it was focused on the pastry arts program, which, to be honest, I didn't even know existed at State until we did that documentary, and it was fascinating to walk into basically a working pastry kitchen, and it was actually, like, you know, a whole bunch of elements of different, you know, pastry and cooking kitchens put together. So it was fascinating to, yeah, it was on the same campus, and they were, you know, producing whole meals and desserts, and I didn't even know this place existed until we did that documentary. So it was nice.
It definitely, the say, like, for it appears that both schools open the doors to explore different areas of the school and meet different people and see different things and kind of learn, oh, there's this here, that's kind of neat, and go back and sit down and eat ice cream with Jesse or you, or throw things at people. We were hooligans.
Just you. You were the worst hooligan.
I think it went Jesse, Anthony, and then me for hooliganness.
And I was nothing but a fucking angel, of course.
Yeah, we all have our college hooligan moments. My favorite hooligan related, I have a lot of great college moments, but my favorite hooligan moment would definitely be, we had the observatory in our college, which is a pub, bar, and pool lounge. So many people would go there and go for their beers. But I did that now and again, but I'm a bit of a penny pincher, so I wasn't really one for going to the bar frequently and paying $7 per pint. So whenever we had our prep nights, which is, it was late at night, it was the day before our weekly studio program, we would get to do our rehearsals and dry runs of our studio shows that we were going to be doing next morning. So us and a couple other students, what we did was, is we would go to the LCBO, not just a 5-minute walk from the college, and we would grab a couple tall boys and we would bring it into the back. And I remember when I was doing I was doing camera operator. That was a fun position to do. There was the set in the studio room, which is the, you know, brick wall, but behind it, it was all attached with wooden studs. So me and this guy, Tom, what we would do is we would take our beers and we would set them on the 2x4s. And whenever people would screw up our shots or we were waiting for the studio end to get the show rolling, we would just lean over, grab our beers, and just have a good time and enjoy it. We were responsible, though. We never did our shows with hangovers or anything. We just created a nice, memorable night that made it a little bit more silly than it normally would.
I don't know if alcohol was involved in any of our silliness. It just came naturally to most of us, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, Saint was kind of isolated, I guess. It was kind of an isolated campus. The only place to get alcohol was the campus bar. Algonquin's a little more, for those who don't know Algonquin, it's a little more kind of integrated into the city. Like, there's, you know, apartments and streets and stuff nearby, whereas Saint is kind of, would you say it's on a hill, Joel? It's kind of a little more isolated, so.
You overlook this city skyline, you can ride your skateboard 10 minutes to a Peter's drive-in, but.
Oh, Peter's drive-in was fantastic. That was, yeah.
And you don't get that anymore.
Yeah, no.
We have, right beside Algonquin College, we have a big strip mall. And there's 24-hour grocery store, 24-hour pizza place, a lot of 24-hour places. Lots of clothing stores, beer store, Lipo, as mentioned. And that entire strip mall, is the name of it is College Square. So it's such a big integration. So literally, that little area can be an entire city.
Jeez. Yeah, it was kind of like that. Like, it was a little bit further. But there were certain spots. Like, there's the grocery store. There's the train station. There was the liquor store right next to the comic book store, which you can guess which one I visited more of.
Oh, Joel went to the comic book store so often, they knew him by name and gave him a 10% discount on everything.
I don't collect comics anymore, but I.
But he has quite the collection. It's enormous.
There's nice. many comics. What would you say is her biggest hooligan moment? What would be the most?
Our biggest hooligan moment?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, it definitely involved Jesse.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't. Well, you and Jesse were more often alone than. I was, because Jesse lived on campus most of the time.
Yeah, so. And I crashed at his place a fair number of times. I think the biggest moment that I remember still was in the sub-basement, and I don't know if Matthew knows about the sub-basement at Sate. It's haunted.
It's very spooky. Yeah.
And we were down there watching Christmas movies. We just wrapped up first semester, I think. And
we watched Charlie Brown Christmas. I remember that. Yeah, there was a little projection theater, and you can watch stuff in it. Yeah.
And we watched it, but we were kind of joking around, and we scared Jesse so bad that he was literally gone and at the end of this very long hallway in like 10 seconds because of scared him. Because there's a little crawl space next to the old theater chairs. So someone had crawled under this crawl space, kind of lifted it, and a hand came out and grabbed Jesse, and Jesse was gone. So.
Oh, I remember that. Oh, my God.
And then that area produced a lot of memories.
The whole sub-basement was very, very creepy. For anyone who's thinking of going to SAIT, what was the building we were in again?
Senator Burns.
Senator Burns, yeah. Go check out the sub-basement of the Senator Burns building. Even if you have nothing to do with the Senator Burns building, go check out that sub-basement. And it's just one of the creepiest spaces I've ever been in. And I've been in, like, abandoned, destroyed houses. And, like, that was creepy. The sub-basement was creepy.
And they have, like, little children toys sitting in the back that are used for props. You just get
weird. And, like, flickering lights and bathrooms that make weird noises.
Bathrooms that suddenly turn on the faucet and turn off the faucet. Just very weird place.
I really enjoy, like, freaky horror paranormal stuff, and I mentioned my favorite hooligan moment, but my favorite hooligan moment that's more on a, you know, professional level, not screwing around, would be, we had an EFP production, we had to make a drama, and I was so happy that the director I was working with wanted to do something that was kind of on the horror theme. So we created this video called Shadows, and it came at a bad time because towards the end of the semester, I was balancing working part-time.
Sorry, I had to sneeze. Yeah.
Working part-time while trying to finish the last semester. So I remember we were shooting so late, and I had to work early the next day. But I didn't really care because I was having so much fun. It was getting a little bit cold, but basically the video was about this girl who goes to this. The gas station was actually on a populated road, but it looked like it was in the middle of nowhere. So we used that to our advantage of shooting this girl who kind of ends up seeing something weird and creepy. And then she ends up getting scared and driving away in that. And my favorite camera moment would be we had someone's car, and I had one of those $3,000 Sony cameras under my arm, and I was inside a trunk with the lid open, and I was holding the camera with part of it sticking out of the vehicle, and I was recording backwards as this other car is chasing us down a road. And to do this, we were on a country road that was actually near my grandfather's house, which was fun. So I got to film this car coming towards me and going from side to side, driving away. It was scary, it was dangerous, but damn, it was worth it.
Oh yeah, sometimes you just gotta get that shot.
Yeah, I think there was a couple photos up on Facebook of, you know, Jesse with this $10,000 camera on his shoulder being, you know, wheeled around in a chair on top of a desk and, like, crawling over and under things. And my father used to do videos himself as well. He was what got me into it a little bit. And he used to do backflips off roofs. This was back in, like, the 80s when, you know, you had to do everything practically. He used to do backflips off roofs to get cool shots. Which, don't do backflips off roofs, children. We're giving terrible advice here. But I think the advice we do want to give is find practical ways to do things. There's so much reliance on CGI and everything these days, but when you're just starting out, you want to find practical ways to do things, like a camera in the trunk of a car where another car is chasing it, or, you know, climbing up on desks to get shots from above and stuff. So finding practical ways to work around limitations is a huge skill and can produce some really, really cool shots.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's why movies, old movies from the 70s and 80s that are re-released on Blu-ray and soon hope to be 4K, is you would think, why would you want to see a movie that's so old? It's not going to look that good. But let me tell you, it does look good, and it looks way better when you see an upscaled or not upscaled, a better quality version of a movie that has practical effects, because it's real, seen better. When you have a 90s movie, so a movie that's 10 years newer, and it's all got CGI on it, and you look at it and you laugh at it because it looks like crap.
Oh, yeah, because it doesn't hold up well, and especially now with... Like this year, Civil War came out, and looking at how much CGI was in that, and you compare that to something in the 90s, you're like,
Yeah, and like all the arrows being CGI in The Hobbit, like, really bugged me. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just unnecessary. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, like, Labyrinth just got a re-release in 4K and Ultra HD, and that was puppetry, and I'm very excited to see that in Blu-ray and 4K, because it was all... practical puppetry and practical effects, so I'm very excited to see that in 4K.
Practical effects are the way to go.
Especially for horror gore.
Yep.
Oh yeah, something like The Shining or Carrie with, you know, pea soup vomiting in The Exorcist and stuff like that.
The ones that stand out the most to me that I've seen on Blu-ray that are re-released is, I think it was Stanley Kubrick. Stanley Kubrick's The Thing. No, yes. Not Stanley Kubrick. Jesus, I'm John Carpenter's The Thing. John Carpenter's The Thing from the 80s. That had some awesome, awesome practical effects, as well as both The Evil Dead 1 and 2, particularly the first Evil Dead. It has practical effects and stop motion. And actually, there's not as much, but still some stop motion in Evil Dead 2, but those movies, oh, those practical effects, the pus and the guts just look absolutely awesome, because it was something real. They took, like, mixtures of goop stuff that looks like the real thing, and they use it. It's not some, like, come on, take a look at the new Freddy Krueger. He has green screening on his face. It's like, really? You put all that work into this makeup for this guy, and you still resort to putting the CGI on his face? Like, really?
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's definitely... You need to be smart about what you're using stuff for. Use your resources for specific reasons. Don't just, let's CGI it just for the hell of it.
Yeah, and it's a really good skill, too, because, like, I've seen some of the setups for doing some of these new movies, and it's rooms and rooms of just render farms. And, you know, you're starting out, you don't have that. You don't have those skills, you don't have that equipment. So learning to do it practically is a really good step to learning to do it with CGI, and you get that experience, you know, before you can get the more advanced stuff.
Yeah, and I think we've imparted much wisdom, and I've learned a lot. I've learned many things, so I'm quite I continue to learn. That's the nice thing about this industry is you never stop learning. So. Any closing remarks?
This industry is changing literally every day. Literally every day there's new things happening and new exciting things. 4K's coming, 8K's coming, VR and 3D are coming. So it's a wonderful industry to be in, and it's ever-changing, and you will learn so, so much.
Couple things that I like to say is anybody who is afraid at the word television broadcasting because they feel television is going the way of the dodo bird, I would say to them, don't be afraid, because it's only the distribution method that's changing. Everything has to be edited. Everything has to be shot. Robots will take over specific tasks, but they will never, ever have the creativity that our minds bring to the table. And the other thing I'd like to say is always be ready. As mentioned earlier in the podcast about keeping your hobby and turning that into your career, always be on the ready, because as mentioned, that phone call, that opportunity that comes up, you never know when that's going to happen. That it could happen the very next day, as it did for me. So just always be ready, always be willing to do new things.
Oh yeah. I echo both sentiments, and Yeah, I love what I do, so it's really easy for me to be like, I make these sacrifices and I'll just kind of keep going and keep making stuff and having fun and meeting really awesome people. It was really awesome to meet you, Matthew. This is the first time we've ever talked, so I've heard many stories, and now we need you to meet Jesse. Because I feel
I'm going to drag him out to Calgary someday. I'll meet Jesse.
Yes, thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I had a lot of fun, and I certainly hope that I'll be able to join you on future episodes. And absolutely, I do have plans to, when the day is right, head on over and
meet the famed Joel and Jesse in person.
Exactly. We can go climb a mountain.
Jesse will get lost, but that happens a lot. So, Any social media you guys would like to plug?
I, of course, would like to plug in my YouTube channel that I've been working so dearly on over the years, is youtube.com/MatthewRS7, where you will find many entertaining videos. I'm a variety channel, so you never know what I'm going to be pumping out next.
Any social media for you, T?
I have my own YouTube channel now that just started, Albino T-Rex, and you can also find me on Twitter at albino_T-Rex. I just started. I only have a couple things up right now. Most of them pranks on Matthew and Matthew doing gross things. So if you like watching people eat gross beans and muffins, and a lot to do with food, actually, come to think about it. So yeah, Albino T-Rex.
And you can find me at Twitter and Instagram at Joel Johnson TV, and as well as StickBoyYYC. We've got lots of good things coming along, and there's some pictures posted, and many adventures still to be had. And thank you for tuning in, and we'll be continuing this conversation and continue many more as time goes on. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back.